This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. But Bloomberg Business Week, the new issue now out on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and of course on the Bloomberg terminal. And in it, how Wrigley Field, home to the Chicago Cubs, holy ground for baseball fans, is also now the ground of DraftKings, which is coming for your dumb money. So says the headline on our story. So let's get into it with Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber. He's on the Access line in Massachusetts, along with Bloomberg News Projects and Investigations reporter Peter Robeson. He is on the phone from Washington State. Peter, it's an incredible story, and truly we were all talking about what's going on between DraftKings and over at Wrigley Field. So tell us about your story and what you set out to find out.
Thanks. It's a story about the sports book that's opening at this incredibly iconic stadium, Wrigley Field in Chicago. A sports book is this Las Vegas style place where you can bet on sports and gamble, which are now allowed in many states around the country. And it's an interesting subject because these betting apps are still fairly new, to many people, and they may not understand about what they're getting into. So our story tried to look at what the odds are as you bet, how companies use data to understand their customer bases, and subjects like that.
You know, sports, they're changing, and a lot of it has to do with gaming and gambling here, Joel.
And baseball is a particularly interesting sport to choose. And, this has just been a really interesting area of coverage that Peter's been all over so far this year. But Peter, why baseball? Why Wrigley Field? And is this not desecration of a hallowed ground?
It's an interesting question. There are people who have opinions about how the Cubs have been managed under the Ricketts family, which has taken a more sort of dollars and cents approach to this franchise. Which games at Wrigley always had this kind of lo-fi feel. You had Harry Carey singing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" in the seventh inning, and the bleacher bums. And next year when you go to a game, you'll see this very fancy glass-walled bar at the corner of Addison and Sheffield. And while you can't pass between the stadium and the sports book, which may show some of the ambivalence that the league still has about gambling, it will be promoted to you as you go to a game, and the hope is that especially in these days when the Cubs are well out of the wild card race, that you spend some time thinking about whether, Ian Happ will get two hits in that game and put some money on it.
Yeah, Peter, I mean, I'm no stranger to a Vegas sports book, but to have it right at the stadium is really a unique idea. Talk to us about the Ricketts family here. I mean, they've done a lot of new and progressive things since they took ownership from Tribune.
They have. They've made some needed updates. The bleachers were falling apart. There weren't even video boards in the stadium until the last several years. So they've put in video boards, and they've also made some improvements around the stadium. There's a boutique hotel now. There's team offices and a conference center. There's a retail store, it's definitely made the experience nicer for fans. You do talk to some fans who say it feels more like Cubs Disneyland now that the sort of monetization is a little bit in your face, and there's nothing more monetizing than these betting apps, which are really trying to monetize things down to pitch by pitch. You can even bet on whether the next pitch will be a ball or a strike.
Okay, so let's talk more about that, because if you're into sports betting, you know all about this already, but maybe for the uninitiated, how is it advanced, and what is DraftKings' specialty?
Well, the thing that really surprised me in reporting this story is that DraftKings publicly, at least to investors, shows a lot of confidence in its ability to control its and manage its user base. Jason Robbins, the CEO, talks about sharp management. He talks about the ability the company has to limit bets from professionals that it expects to win. And in some cases, that's because, you know, these may be international syndicates or algorithmic bettors that are betting millions of dollars on a game. But we've heard about complaints even from smaller dollar bettors who say they aren't able to get their bets in once the app, you know, sort of targets that bettor as a sharp bettor. And that's a key advantage that these apps have right now. And it's one that they even highlight in their securities filings, that you know, this discretion they have over individual customer accounts is something that, you know, we cannot assure you investors that will be there forever. And so there's some skepticism that some people have about whether the playing field is truly level if you're just an average recreational user.
Well, Peter, I'm not throwing you some shade, but I'm assuming you're not a professional gambler or bettor. But you did try out the app. What was your experience with it? And maybe what insight did it give to you about maybe, you know, the average Joe or Jane playing around with this app?
Yeah, I would put myself in that category as a first-time user of this app. If you listen to these ads that are, you know, kind of ubiquitous during sporting events, you get the idea that free money is there for the taking. And I, you know, I signed up at a time when the DraftKings was offering a 20% bonus on deposits up to $1,000. So I put in $200 and I bet on a parlay with a combination of events that would have to happen for the bet to pay out. And I quickly lost my money on that first bet. But the interesting thing was that the deposit did not come back in the way I expected. I had thought it, from a quick glance at this promotion, that I would get $40 back if I lost this $200. Instead, in the fine print, it says you get a dollar back for every $25 wagered, and you get it in playable credits. So I ended up with $8 in playable credits instead.
All right, hot dog with that?
And at this point, I'm back home. This is in Illinois where I could bet, but now I'm back home in Washington State where if I want to play around with that further, I have to go into a casino.
All right, we got to leave it there. Guys, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. It is a great story. Peter Robeson, Projects and Investigations reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from Washington State. Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, on the Access Line in Massachusetts. The story in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Paul, it's out? Newsstands, online?
It's interesting. Just 5 years ago, professional sports wouldn't have had anything to do with gambling. Now they are all over.
Remember, like, they wouldn't even touch it, right? For fear of being tainted. All right, coming up, we're checking on the markets.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we do want to talk a bit more about the crypto world. You did hear Bill Maloney talking about Bitcoin down more than 4%. Ethereum is down about 8.5%, really a risk-off trade today. So with that in mind, let's get to our weekly crypto segment. Back with us is Grayscale Investment CEO Michael Sonnenschein. Grayscale, manager of the world's largest BTC fund. He is joining us back with us on the phone in New York City. Hey, Michael, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
It's good to have you here. We are living in an interesting time. What's top of mind for you right now when it comes to where we are in the progression of the crypto world? I know you guys are continuing to pursue a lawsuit with the SEC about your own application and rejection for the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust to make it into an ETF. Tell us, though, where we are in this world, especially as we continue to see volatility within the crypto asset world.
Well, I think it's really about patience from an investor perspective. You know, personally, I've been in the crypto space about 9 years, as has Grayscale, and we've seen drawdowns of greater than 50%, you know, multiple times. And, you know, each time we do see a pullback in prices, whether it's leverage coming out of the system, monetary policy, or other factors that are causing selling pressure in the crypto space, what I do find is each time this occurs, the crypto system ecosystem gets stronger, demonstrates its resiliency, continues to build, and I'm confident the same is going to happen with this recent pullback that we've been experiencing.
Hey, Michael, you know, it's very rare for investors to, you know, really participate, observe the creation and evolution of an asset class, and I kind of feel like that's what we're enjoying right now. My question, I got a million questions, but one of them is just kind of, where are we? Like, what inning of this baseball game are we in the evolution of crypto?
I would argue we're still in the parking lot. We just got to the game.
You're right.
Yes, we're still tailgating, right? I think that, you know, this is maybe the bottom of the first inning. And I think the reason that I feel so confident sharing that is because we've barely scratched the surface on the development of use cases for crypto assets. You know, we are in the middle now of seeing how and why the crypto ecosystem is developing some fantastic applications, but we're still not yet at a place where the pipes and the, you know, the plumbing is really connecting the crypto ecosystem to the legacy financial system. And as you see that play out, which I think you'll see over the next 18 months or so, you're going to see a lot more user adoption and a lot more use cases that folks will be able to bring into their everyday lives around crypto.
So if we're that early in on the game, Michael, don't you think the SEC is right in rejecting, you know, to change your Grayscale Bitcoin Trust to ETF or make it into an ETF, that application? If we're that early in the game, maybe they're right to kind of slow the roll when it comes to our move into crypto. And, you know, their argument is that the market is not mature enough, doesn't have enough, you know, market manipulation and fraud prevention measures to protect, you know, consumers. Maybe they're right.
You know, Carol, that argument maybe stood up a couple of years ago, but today, you know, when we're talking about Bitcoin specifically, you're talking about a market that is as healthy as it's ever been. It's a two-sided market. It's highly sophisticated. It's global in nature. It's 24/7. We have the development of lending, borrowing. We have derivatives. And we now have multiple Bitcoin futures-based ETFs here in the U.S. And so I think the counter argument to what you're saying is that, you know, really the SEC isn't actually protecting anybody by sitting on the sideline here, right? If we can give investors the ability to access Bitcoin through the familiarity, through the protections of the ETF wrapper, then aren't investors better off accessing Bitcoin under a product that is under regulatory supervision and scrutiny than perhaps accessing it directly? Because investors are still accessing Bitcoin every day. Investors are still trading in GBTC every day. And so we think it's a missed opportunity to not bring that product closer in to the regulatory perimeter.
You know, Michael, I've been in these markets for 35 years, and by and large, I've been kind of, you know, a little slowness, a little extra regulation maybe isn't the worst thing, particularly as it relates to retail investors, unless somebody can tell me that we as the United States really run the risk of falling behind other parts of the world, other countries in the development of a security, an asset class, a product. Do we run the risk of falling behind other parts of the world in crypto?
Oh, that risk is already quite real.
Okay.
What you're definitely seeing is other geographies where either governments are taking a much more active approach to the development of central bank digital currencies. They may be already having enacted laws or rules around, you know, favorable taxation considerations around crypto assets and crypto trading. You have certain parts of the world that have even adopted things like Bitcoin as a form of legal tender. And unfortunately, you know, the crypto ecosystem is not going to wait for the U.S. government or others to, you know, kind of catch up on the regulatory front. So we do run the risk of pushing some of these innovators, some of these companies, some of that job growth outside the U.S. if we don't have that, you know, proper infrastructure.
Michael, really quick, 25 seconds. So where does this leave you with your suit against the SEC? Any update? Very quickly, please.
We have common sense arguments around this. We feel very strongly that this is the best thing for investors, and we will continue to put the full resources of the firm behind it.
All right, we got to run. Hey, listen, great to check in with you again. Grayscale Investment CEO Michael Sonnenschein joining us on the phone in New York City.
CRYP Go, that's our crypto function on the Bloomberg Terminal. Got some good stuff there. Brings a lot of the different securities together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like a lot more to be known, I think, when
it comes into
the integration into kind of the financial establishment. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, can't believe it. 10 minutes away from wrapping up the Friday trading session and really wrapping up what has been a week where we counted down every day to Jay Powell. We heard from him earlier today. And as a result, Paul, we had stocks selling off. We're pretty much hovering near our lows of the session, a risk-off trade,
yeah,
no doubt about
it. I mean,
it.
They delivered for those people that were looking for a bombshell, the S&P off 3.2%. That really gets your attention.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's see what gets our next guest's attention. Leo Kelly is back with us, founder and CEO at Verdance Capital Advisors. He's on the phone from Hunt Valley, Maryland. Leo, nice to have you back with us here on Bloomberg Business Week and joining Paul and myself. So, I don't know. What's the long-term investment strategy now that we've heard from Jay Powell in your view? Or can you even make that bet?
I think you definitely can make the bet. You have to just understand that that which has worked in the past doesn't necessarily work going forward. We've talked about this in the last time I was on. Mm-hmm. What we are getting is confirmation that this inflation issue is not something that just magically goes away. This is not a temporary or an issue that is just a result of some short-term anomaly. This is real. It's going to take a lot of effort. And I think it signals a secular change in interest rate movements and the end of a 40-year bull market in bonds. So the way you have to invest, Carol, mm-hmm. is you have to look at inflation oriented investments, value, international, private investments, real estate, and you have to be extraordinarily careful with your bond portfolios. The days of 60-40, right, put it in and go to sleep, I think, are behind us.
So what do we do in that kind of scenario there? I mean, it sounds like, again, what we heard with clarity today was looking at inflation very aggressively, acting against it very aggressively, even at the risk of recession. I'm not sure where I go in that environment. What would you be telling some of your clients here with fresh money?
Well, I think what we heard from Powell today shouldn't have been a surprise. I was surprised at how aggressive he was with the language. I thought he'd be a little bit more balanced. But, I mean, we heard Esther George earlier say, hey, this inflation thing's not over. That was earlier in the week. I don't think going from 9.1 to 8.5 signals the end of inflation. And so I do think what Powell said today, kind of in a hidden fashion, was our third mandate is no longer a mandate. And that is the protection of asset prices and the protection of wealth or the wealth effect in the country is no longer our mandate. It has been for about 15, 20 years, the unspoken mandate. And that's over. That's, by the way, how serious this inflation issue is. So you have to start to look at investments that do well in inflationary environments, whether it's commodities or industrials, real estate, financials. There's places to put money in this kind of environment. I would also say, Paul, one other point, and that is, remember, the market is already pricing in really a problematic environment. We were down 20%. Mm-hmm. We've had a nice summer rally. It's very rare that bear markets go down once and then go off to the next bull market.
Right.
This is the normal course of working through a bear market.
Well, Vince Signorella, he's a macro strategist here at Bloomberg. He spent decades on the street trading. He has a bullish call, which I know others share, which is, hey, inflation's coming down anyway. This Fed's going to raise a little bit, then they're going to stand pat, and that's going to set the stage for a risk-on rally into the end of this year. I mean, we had some housing data that came out today. You know, you had some University of Michigan sentiment data came out today. Gasoline now down below $4 a gallon. Some of those inflation things are, in fact, coming down. Is that set the stage for maybe this Fed kind of, okay, giving us 75 and then maybe sitting on the sidelines a little bit?
Well, if you keep raising rates 75 basis points a meeting, sooner or later, inflation will start coming down.
Yep.
You know, if we keep beating the consumer over the head, they'll slow down their spending. I mean, we're heading into a little bit different world now. We're starting to see consumer discretionary spending start to back off, and consumers are going to have to start making a choice.
Yep.
And hopefully,
they already are in a big way over in Europe. We've seen that.
Yeah, and in Europe, they've gotten to the point of really some severe choices.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up through the first big oil push and inflation run, and you know, we lived in a kind of a modest upbringing, and I remember the choice between food and heat a couple months. Wow. And that's a tough choice to make. And because of the inflation in energy prices in Europe, they're making those kind of choices this winter. So, inflation will come down because of inflation. And that eventually works. But aware of the signal.
But at what cost, right? And I think about, as you say, individuals, the choices you had to make or your family had to make at one point. And you do wonder, I mean, Jay Powell even talked about that, you know, certainly the cost for some individuals, it's going to be tougher than others.
The cost is significant, but there's a greater cost in not taking care of this right now, because this is an insidious tax, and especially on low to middle income consumers. Because remember, even if we come down from 9 or 8.5 down to 5, that's 5 over the previous year's inflation, which is over the previous year's inflation. So until we get to disinflation, we're not taking prices down. We're just growing the cost slower. So there's a lot here to unpack for Powell. And I think this was a clear signal for the Fed to be this hawkish for the first time in as long as I can remember, right, since the mid-90s probably, they were this hawkish. That says that they are seeing that this inflation is not over. And energy is a very volatile asset, as we know.
Hey, Leo, really quickly, like 20 seconds, are we headed for a really problematic market potentially next year?
No, I actually, as bearish as I may, may sound, you know, we actually
think. Hence my question.
Sure. No, I think, remember, that's the point of a bear market, right? Prices go and move in advance of all of this, and we've already been down 20. What we've warned investors is, bear markets are volatile. It takes a few knocks at the bottom before you come out of them. But I will tell you, we are less apt to sell into rallies. We are more apt to buy into dips.
Okay.
Because we still have to rebuild the supply chain, rebuild inventories.
Got it.
And when inflation slows down, the consumer should be fine.
All right. You have a good weekend. Leo Kelly, founder and chief executive officer of Verdins Capital Advisors, joining us on the phone from Hunt Valley, Maryland. He did sound pretty bearish.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.